Ladies and gentlemen, your guest is confused right now, but let me explain. We've come back in time, and now we're telling people what they just listened to in terms of the subject matter, who our guest is. That's you, David Hyde.
I'm with you back
and
to
that's
the
me.
Future.
My name is Tavin Allen. I'm the host of what you're listening to right now, which is Comedy Above the Pub. That's Cappy to you and me. The pub is fake. The guests are real. We are part of Entertainment One's podcast network and could not be happier to be there. Now, David Hyde is with us. He is a fantastic director. Has directed two shows that are popular in this house, Property Brothers and Come Dine With Me Canada, as well the, I always screw up the name of it, what's the ice truck one?
Ice Road Truckers.
That's the one, Ice Road Truckers. And more importantly, what you're here to talk about, Stegman Is Dead, a wonderful film released in Toronto recently, coming out on iTunes
December 12th,
along also on Super Channel.
That's it.
Which I found out I get.
Free.
I found out I get that.
Yeah, don't tell Rogers.
Here's the reason. You throw enough money at Rogers, they throw you that. Oh, you want hockey and Super Channel? Yeah, help yourself. Like, that's it. We own your soul, Todd. What do we talk about, Dave? We talk about, first of all, your film career. What else do we talk about? Our favorite directors? We talk about how you piece things together in terms of what you do. Your mind and things. There's also behind-the-scenes chat of reality shows that you've been on. Right?
There was certainly some of that.
What else do we cover?
We covered a little... the one thing we didn't cover that was really more significant in my world than the reality show were the 4 1-hour documentaries, entertainment documentaries.
All right.
Documentary film is fantastic because if you're making them for broadcasters,
right,
then you can actually make a living doing it.
Right.
Unlike independent film.
Right.
Which you work on 90% of the time for free.
We teased to it with the Elvis Costello chat.
And we 100% did.
This man... spent a lot of time with Elvis Costello. Like, a lot of time. It's amazing having you down here. So make sure you check out Stegman Is Dead when it comes out December 12th on iTunes. If you're in Winnipeg this weekend, make sure you go see that. Speaking of things, very quickly, David, what am I up to? December 7th through the 10th, the Thursday through the Sunday, I'm in Ottawa at Absolute Comedy. I will be doing the next round of Write 'Em Up on January 6th, and that is at Comedy Bar. And January 19th, the Comedy Appetizer here in Toronto. Here is David. Here is me. Thank you so much. Go see Stegman Is Dead and listen to us right now. Do you ever get so detailed on something you just go, oh, why can't I just enjoy the thing I'm in, and instead of like focusing on this minute detail that means absolutely nothing? Does that ever happen to you?
No, you know, I think it absolutely has, but
okay,
I am quite good at just letting go.
Really?
So I am. I can get there. Like, I can let go and I can just be happy and I can be doing my thing. And if I'm on cruise control, I really am in that mode. And I don't get pulled out of it very easily, but I will say.
Yes.
There are times when, you know, I'm deconstructing something or working on something and I will get trapped in a detail that is irritating and takes away from the final mission that I'm looking to move toward. And so I share that with you for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've started meditating, hoping that will shut out the voices. And all it's really done is, I've got to find time to meditate. Yeah. Like, that's all I've, you know. Why can't I find 10 minutes to shut off my stupid head?
Yeah, T-minus 9 minutes until I meditate.
Right. Exactly.
T-minus 8 minutes until
I'm listening to a British guy telling me to breathe. Okay, that's all I'm doing right now.
Hilarious.
Really funny. Yeah, that's it. How do you self-maintain? Because you're a busy man. Let me tell you this, Mr. David Hyde. You are a hard person to Google if you don't like Fraser. If you don't like Fraser, you are one of the toughest people to find.
David Hyde Pierce
has
ruined my Google for 20 years. It's like about in 2001 or 2000, somewhere around there, I won Too Much Music Video Awards.
Right.
And I had a really fantastic time doing it. I was so excited to see my name under Google. Mm-hmm. By the way, this is 15 years ago, so you know how Google back then was a much bigger deal than it is now. Now it's like every day, hi, I'm Googling and taking a shower. No big deal.
Right.
It's like back then it was like you Google and you want to see something. And I would Google myself and there was nothing but David Hyde Pierce. And so that guy has been in my way for a long time.
Right.
I got to figure out about AdWords or something. Mm-hmm. Try and buy a head of Pierce.
Or, how do you stop that? Because it's so aggregated. It's the, we had a guy on here who was also in the film industry, who had the exact same name of a guy who was arrested for filming child pornography.
Oh, no. Okay, you know what? You've made me feel better, because at least I do not have that.
It was the exact same name, exact same spelling.
Oh, no.
Because he was sitting in the chair where you are. He goes, Google my name.
Oh, no.
I go, okay. So I Google it. And I look and go, oh, okay. Yeah. So another guy shares your name. Go, yeah, click that first link if you would. I'm like, okay. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They came after you immediately.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
no, that's terrible. So thank you very much for gifting me that, because I'm not in such a bad predicament.
No.
I will say, though, I'm not even in the number two spot. I'm in number three, because when you put in David Hyde Pierce comes up first.
Right.
And then David Hyde, the security advisor, comes up second.
Oh, right.
He owns some fancy security firm.
Right.
And it's quite well-renowned.
Okay.
And, you know, like, North America-wide, David Hyde, install cameras in your home and mm-hmm. bring special dogs and to your house. So, I'm just behind those two guys.
Uh-huh. certainly with net neutrality going away, you'll be able to buy your way to the top.
Is that really going? Isn't that a disaster?
I don't know.
That's not going away, is it?
I think Canada is safe.
A weird threat.
Yeah, I think Canada is safe because I think Trudeau certainly understands what net neutrality means to everyone that follows him. They'll have to pay more for Instagram that they get for free to see me? Nope, not happening. So I think we're fine. But definitely everything is just, you know, hell with the lid off down south.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I find those issues to be so complicated that you can't really – it used to be that I worked at CBC mm-hmm. in news for years.
Right.
And it used to be that if you spent 15 minutes, you could more or less understand an issue. The sound bites and the news clarification was good mm-hmm. enough that you would get it. This net neutrality stuff is so complicated, I can't really understand whether it's good or bad. And in some of the articles that I have read, trying to get a handle on it,
right.
I've heard that Canada already doesn't have any net neutrality. And we're already geo-blocked in significant ways. And obviously that's wrong.
Right.
Because I'm sure you know more. But
David. I would not say that. We're geo-blocked in like Netflix, for sure. But I think that's more a hangover from, like, I don't know why that is. Like, whether it's a hangover from, like, PAL and NTSC, like, VCR cassettes or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know what the reason is. But I think that, you know, in terms of our ability to get it, I would say that overall we're priced high, but we're used to that in this country anyway.
Yeah.
So, but I don't think our access is being denied. And I think that's what it is.
Like, that's what it is. Okay.
It's more of a pay to play. Like, the things that I've seen to counter net neutrality are like people going, hey, we don't have it in Portugal, and this is what you can deal with. And it's like, for $3.99 a month, you get these four apps. And for $4.99, you get these six apps. And then it's like,
that's the actual proposal.
Yeah, so you could have like Instagram, but not Twitter. And then you could have Twitter, but not Netflix. And then you could have Netflix, but not. So they try to give you packages like.
And who's proposing this, by the way?
It's the U.S. It's the guy in charge of the FCC. Who's. It's. Did you follow the U.S. at all? Because. Okay. Every day, I say this on stage. There should be a Chrome plugin for Twitter that whenever you open it, it just screams at you until you shut it down, because it's never good. Okay, let's see what happened in the news today. Ah, okay, no, and let's try Facebook. Okay, not that either. Like,
yeah.
That's what.
Funny, you're so right.
Because nothing is good.
Yeah,
like at the time of recording. Today it was said that Trump endorsed Roy Moore, who's the pedophile in Alabama. He's the guy. He's a judge running for a Senate seat.
Oh, this
charged
guy.
With dating
They're
a 14-year-old
around the hall, the malls looking mm-hmm. for right. Gotcha, Roy Moore.
Right.
Okay.
He is looking to release a hold on two public parks so that people can drill and mine them. His travel ban went through because of the seat that he was able to secure in the Supreme Court, and his lawyer said he's above the law and can't be accused.
Accused of
can't be accused. That's Monday.
Yeah,
Monday. We have four more days of this shit before.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, before it gets there. Well, listen, you know, it's always been said.
Yeah.
Long before there was social media and the internet and Google.
Uh huh.
That good news does not sell.
No.
So I don't know whether or not social media is responsible or how we're going to do it, but I'll tell you that gossip and bad news always is what people want to hear because they like to latch on to the negative.
Right. I just saw this Mark Twain quote the other day, and I don't know if you know about Mark Twain. Bit of a pensmith.
Yeah.
He's got a way with words.
So they say.
Yeah. And I think he was talking about lies and truth, but it could also be good news, bad news. And let's go with my first instinct, thinking that it's like good news, bad news, lies and truth. Lies will be halfway around the world at the same time the truth is putting on his shoes. I was like, oh my God, that is fantastic. And a nice image. You know what? I can't wait for his next work. That's why I'm here. I want to get back to because this is one of the things I love about directors and you in particular. You said you won like two MTV directorial awards.
Well, we got to make sure we stay Canadian. So okay. MTV, I wish, but in fact, they were Much Music,
oh, Much Music Awards, okay,
which is the Canadian version.
Right,
of those,
right. Yeah. The MMVAs.
The MMVAs, that's
yes.
It. Yep.
And not the MMMVAs, which would be the Much More Music VAs.
That were right. No, those are less cool than MM.
Yes.
The three M's, the two M's are cooler. Yeah.
Well, here's the difference. I think the MMMVAs would have stained achieving a Lifetime Achievement Award at some point, whereas I did that joke strictly for me because I was forced to remember who Stained was the other day.
Oh, that's a band, isn't it?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Gotcha. They did, it's been a while since it's that thing. It was like that 90s hair grunge, you know.
Gotcha.
Where it's just guys going, been a while. That was it.
I figured out you're a music guy.
Nope.
Come on. No?
No, I am, but like none that anyone cares about. So this is why I'm interested. So what were the music videos? Do you remember?
Oh, of course. Well, the ones I won for, I remember. Yes. But I have directed over 20 of them. But I'll say this also.
Rattle them off. Let's hear.
Yeah, all 20?
Yeah, okay. Well, the ones of note that you're particularly
I won a Much Music Video Award for an Ashley MacIsaac video.
Which one?
When he joined forces with Mary Jane LeMond on her record.
Right.
And it was right in the wheelhouse of when his most famous song, which was called...
I know it too.
The Devil.
Yeah. It's not The Devil's Haircut. That's Beck. It's not. Hang on.
Let me
do this for you. I'll do it for you.
Okay.
See, this is the other thing that I think how are you with bar bets?
I haven't engaged very often.
Okay.
But I don't bet very much. And by the way, I don't understand gambling. But I think I would be good at it.
Right. But like, Ashley McKay. Okay. So. What I'm saddened by.
The Devil's Pajamas or something.
I don't know. You know what? You're very close.
Yeah, it was.
It's The Devil in the Kitchen.
Devil in the Kitchen.
The Devil in the Kitchen.
Devil in the Kitchen. Okay. Right in the era when he was hot.
Right. So the reason I ask about bar bets is that I will be in a situation where it was very similar to this. Go, no, it's something else, not something else. And this is how Stained happened. And so finally, like I will give a cutoff for like 5 or 10 minutes when my buddies and I are bantering back and forth, figuring out what something is. And we finally go, okay, we're going to the book. And then we pick up the phone and do it. Finally. But there's money on the table if it's that.
I love it.
So can I guess what the song was?
Oh, you could.
Sleepy Maggie?
No.
Oh.
It'll be tough because it was.
Excuse me.
It was truly an Ashley MacIsaac song, but it was a collaboration that he had with a Gaelic singer named Mary Jane LeMond. She sang on Sleeping Maggie and some of his other tunes, and in return for that, he played on her record.
Okay.
So the music video that I won a Much Music Video Award for was on her record, and it was called Bog a la Shane.
Yeah, I would not have gotten that one. Okay.
But you have heard the song. It was really quite well renowned, and she and Ashley rocked it.
Mm-hmm.
So I won a Much Music Video Award for that. Music Video Award. Yeah, that was fun. It was really a blast to make it. And working with Ashley was everything you've ever heard, plus more. You know, he was notorious back in those days, and it was fun to do that. And let's see, Much Music Video Awards. BTK was a Canadian white boy
BTK!
Rapper.
Yes!
You are a music guy. Only music guys know BTK. Come on. I did three videos for them.
Okay.
And then they ditched me for Evan Bernard, who did the Beastie Boys videos.
Sure, yeah. Okay, that's...
Welcome to Canada.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Man. Okay. I haven't thought of BTK in ages.
Yeah. They made some great tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And We made some very good videos, so I really was happy with those, and we won acknowledgement and embracement for those videos. It was fantastic. It was really good. I made a little video for them called Super Child.
Okay.
This was back 10, 15 years ago when you could grab cameras and we shot for 3 days on, you know, a $15,000 budget.
Right.
And that just doesn't happen anymore. Uh-huh. Like, there's no way. But that's how we made such a great video, because we just had enough grist for the mill to make the edit rock, you know, and we did very well. It was really a blast. And the third Much Music Video Award was for a band called My Brilliant Beast.
Okay. I know you said you weren't a musician.
I know the name.
Yes. I know the name. I couldn't name you one track. But I know My Brilliant Beast.
Well, I'm glad
know
you're not asking name. Me because I think I may have forgotten the name of it. But those were the heydays. And the halcyon times of music videos, because there was truly a fantastic system of financing.
Yep.
And we made a living doing it. It wasn't a great living, but I could literally pay my rent and buy food, keep some shelter, keep some grub in my belly by making music videos. And so did my crew. You know, we made over 20 of them. It was amazing. It was amazing times.
When did you start doing the music videos?
Probably 98.
Okay. Because that was still happening. Because I grew up at the time when Much Music just happened. And then Music Plus came in, which was the French arm of Much Music. So we were growing up in the town that we were, we actually got both. So we could actually switch back and forth and see like what was happening on the French side versus what was happening.
Yeah.
And even then, like even the Canadian videos back then, like you think of... So, like who the bands would have been. Like, I just remember like Sherry Keane's, I Want You Back was like one of the first Canadian videos I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
And it's like, and then you go through like all the music from the '80s, like it was being shaped as much as the US was being shaped. Like, but MTV certainly at that point was just driving people. And so like, there's no reason Phil Collins would ever have a career if it weren't for the fact that his videos were getting, because videos were such novelty.
Yeah.
Right.
No, absolutely. And that was the era of Robert Plant.
Yep.
And not Robert Plant. The era of Robert Plant, of course, was Led Zeppelin. That was back in the day. That was
Robert Palmer.
Robert Palmer.
Yes.
And his, you know, sexy video. And that video really augmented the song. And I think Phil Collins had a strength in that he was truly a fantastic player and songwriter.
Right.
Whereas Robert Palmer, you know, without music videos backing him up, that the success of that single may not have been what it was, you know,
because
it was an amazing video that really changed the face and the direction of how videos were made. So
it was interesting. Like there was that tipping point of like videos were necessary. So a lot of concert footage kind of came out. So like you'd see Christopher Cross, just performing his song in concert and like, oh, that's a video. And this would be for a lot of people, it was the first time they ever saw what Christopher Cross looked like. And like, oh, okay, you know. And then next to that one would be like a Michael Jackson video. And you just go, oh my God, the artistry in that. Because it took on like more of the dance and more of the story and more like giving a plot line to match with the lyrics and stuff like that. Like it was interesting watching the tipping point going from we have musicians who are making videos and now we have people making videos who are actually trying to sell a song.
Yes. And that
was interesting.
You've described that very precisely because there was right in around that moment a turning point. It never used to be that point of purchase merchandising and CD covers and posters and other things that accompany promotion on the road ever matched the music video.
Right.
Music videos were independent pieces of work and they were pretty artful and the band and the director got together and they came up with an idea and they executed it because they wanted it to be cool.
Yeah.
And slowly over time, as the budgets grew and as record companies got more and more involved, they became marketing tools, which changed their sort of reason to be.
Yeah.
And it was no longer look at cool stuff that goes along with this song. It was more like, let's package up a whole marketing plan that we can then sell this song with.
Right. And that's, like, I think, I will say you've hit it on the head as well, because I remember, like, you think of, like, the album covers, like you say, that were a continuation of that arm. Journey's Escape album was a spaceship flying through another spaceship, right? Snap. Like, that's what that was. Not one band member on the cover, nothing. You cut to today, where, oh, who's the artist? You look at the album cover. And they are done up in the same uniform as one of the videos that's going to be on, taken from one of the tracks. Like, you're exactly right. Like, everything seems very meticulous now.
Right down to the color themes of the wardrobe.
Yeah.
Like, you know what? Hey, guess what? The dancing girl's wearing the same color as the point of purchase stand that's sitting in the one or two HMV stores that are left over.
Right. That's one of the things I love about Weezer. Just like, which album is it? The green one.
Yeah.
Which one? Except for Pinkerton, which obviously is. I think they started naming recently. I think. That's right. This is also what I love about directors that kind of pulled it back. And I would lump you in on this because you have done other things other than just music videos. As great as they are, and that contribution is, I love it when I get to fall in love with a director from seeing his original work doing music videos, and then seeing the continuation of the arc of their craft. Because I was able to pick up ages ago these director sets. It was I can't remember the name of the collections, but like Michel Gondry, Spike Jonze, who's the other one? Chris Cunningham.
Right. Yep.
It was three separate videos, and there's more with other directors that compiled all of their music videos that they've done. And the commonality between all of them was that they had all done a Bjork video. They had all done a Beastie Boys. And I think possibly a Beck. I think all three had done one of those. But like the Bjork ones, when you see like all the different takes on how you would do one of those is staggering.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, those guys have got some heads on their shoulders, that's for sure. And they're very, very interesting.
Right.
People in music videos back then allowed that to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, I just don't think it's just really not the same anymore. There's kind of two things happening in my humble exposure to music videos in the year 2017, which is, by the way, very, very humble. And I mean that. It's small. I'm not really involved anymore.
Right.
Although I will promote the Prism Prize Awards here in Canada because they are the alternative music video awards.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And they cover hundreds of videos because now videos are in two categories. They're either made completely independently or they're made through record companies.
Right.
And I used to work in an area that was a middle ground between those two things because we used to be independent funded videos through VideoFact,
right,
which is a fund that's now being canceled by the government.
Right.
Or it was financed by record companies.
Right.
Both of those videos that came out of those two streams of financing had equal chances to be aired on MuchMusic.
Right.
That's not true anymore.
Yeah.
Now what you've got is a whole bunch of people making really super cool indie videos and a whole bunch of people making really super big budget marketing videos.
Right.
I forgot where I was going. I will say that, the indie kids are making some very good work these days.
Yes.
Oh, that's what I was about to say. I think back in the old days, when you name people like Spike Jonze and Chris Cunningham, there were budgets that were big and significant, but they still were super creative.
Yeah.
So those box sets, compilations, are amazing things to look at because there was very, very little interference. I don't think there was anything else made at that price point that had less sort of monetary return attached to it, you know?
Right. The guy that blew me away, because I knew nothing about him, was Gondry. Michel Gondry, even the DVD menu graphic that he did was him sitting in a mini drum set, drumming away with his two kids' heads stuck inside one of the drums. So every time he hit their drum, they'd yell out, ow, like that. And it was incorporated into the rolling piece. He was like, ow, 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 ow. It was like so perfect.
Awesome. You're a drummer.
I am not.
You're not.
Okay. If picture yourself at a cottage or like a house party and someone is a musician and they start divvying up and it's everyone's about five beers in and they go, hey, let's start dividing up the instruments. The least amount of damage I can inflict is drumming. That is the least amount. Give me anything with strings. You're going to hate it. Nothing.
Drums you can do.
Yeah. And ever so basically, like if you want something other than 4/4 time. Not your guy.
Well, that's fine.
Not your
four,
guy.
4/4. Nothing happens at a cottage outside of 4/4 anyway.
Oh, until
it's called like a case of beer and a 4/4 timing, and that's how it goes.
Until you get the jackass who's really good at guitar and goes, "Hey, let's do Salisbury Hill." I'm like, "Oh, you asshole! I'm not counting to five.
No,
no, no. Do you play instruments?
No.
Okay.
Nope.
No.
I mean, I can strum a guitar a little bit.
Sure.
But I don't think I've ever really sat behind a drum kit.
No.
No.
No. No. No. Don't.
Yeah.
Don't. Trust me.
Yep.
I always look at drums like Bart Simpson always kind of looked at reading lips. I just assumed I could do it. You know? No.
Funny.
No, you can't. Ah. Yeah. Is it ditto like anything? My brother is the musician. he'll like figure out, he'll hear three notes out of it, and then like next thing you know, he's composing like eight songs on, you know, like a tuba with a cheese grater on it. And like, I don't know how you did that, but okay.
Okay.
People with talent offend me. Let me tell you that. I don't know how you even got here, David. I mean, I'm all level with you. Because here's the thing. You have, like, the breadth of your resume is so fun because you've got the music videos. By the way, that was another question I wanted to ask you.
Yeah.
If you could go back, and I mean any era, any song, if you could do, you find the artist and you go, I want to do this song. Who's the artist? What's the song? If you could, if you had your pick of whatever song it was that you wanted to direct,
there was a time.
What would you do?
There was a time when Beck, and this may seem a little on the boring and mundane side, but you know, I'm going to speak from the heart.
Yeah.
Because those big hits were the ones that really struck like a spiritual chord, and when you were just able to enjoy something and it wasn't filled with like, who's going to think of this and what are they going to find? It's like, if I was really going to just enjoy something, Beck's song, I Am a Loser, Baby.
Yeah.
Was amazing, and I wish I could have worked on that. I would have loved to have done that. Second, Fiona Apple.
Okay.
Fiona Apple had a song called Criminal.
Yeah.
That song always struck an unbelievable chord with me, and the video is pretty good. I mean, right. It was made by P.T. Anderson, who is no slouch.
Yes, yeah.
But I still wish I had done it.
Uh-huh. I had no idea P.T. Anderson did that.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I got to go back and watch that.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's weird. When did you start to look at directing as the thing that you wanted to do? But was there ever a point where you started going to movies and things because of the director? Because that started with me about 15, 20 years ago, where I was like, I don't care who's in the movie. This is being directed by Aronofsky. I'm going.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I got to go further back. It was the Coen brothers that got me. And I was like, oh, I don't even care who's in it. Who's in the Coen brothers movie? Don't care. I'm watching this because they're doing it.
I'm 100% with you. I mean, the Coen brothers were those people for me, too. Mm-hmm. And they are for many, obviously, you know, I mean.
Is that your favorite? Is that your favorite guys? Who's your favorite directors?
See, I have no answer to that.
Really?
I really don't. And because I equally love several people. And I wouldn't pick one over the other. I just haven't done that. But for instance,
they like may be listening. That's fair enough. We do get notes from the Coens all over the time.
And I wouldn't want them to think that I like Quentin Tarantino the same as I like that. But in fact, I do.
Sure.
No, P.T. Anderson, honestly, he has always been one of my favorites. His earlier work is truly strikes a chord in me. His later films, I love and appreciate, but not the same way that I identify with his earlier films. The Coen brothers are, I mean, I love crime. I mean, I made a film called Stegma is Dead. It's a crime comedy. And in many ways, the Coens were an enormous inspiration for that.
Right.
Along with Tarantino.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like, he has done a bunch of fantastic stuff as well. And his medley of styles is just exciting.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. You watch Pulp Fiction and you're like, well, this is a mainstream big budget movie. But within it is all kinds of Indian genre tones that just make it so special and genius.
Right.
And so all those things I love and appreciate. At the same time, I'm just going to whip out a couple of like really filmy kind of references.
Okay.
But there is a guy that we've all probably heard of at some point in the film world. Not many people outside of it have. Akira Kurosawa. He's a Japanese director.
Yes.
He's made some great films, and I really love those films. And there's a time when I can put on Seven Samurai and literally appreciate it as much as when I am watching Pulp Fiction or Fargo.
Right.
So that's why I just don't have – I've tried for years. Like, who's my favorite? What do I write down? I just don't have one.
Right.
Like, there's moments and moods that come across me where I'm appreciating one more than others and then others more than other ones. You know,
It's like saying what's your favorite song? What's your favorite musician? What's your favorite movie for that matter? Because it's an always changing list that you're always going to get to. So I'm not trying to put you on the spot. But that said, who's your favorite? Come on.
Well, I can pick one for you, but I will tell you, honestly, I don't have one. But I'm going to tell you right now that I love Quentin Tarantino.
Sure.
I think his films are fantastic. I think his really irreverent attitude is also fantastic. I love that he made Django Unchained.
Yep.
You know, I really appreciate his efforts at war movies. I think they're fantastic because they're just sort of imbued with so much weird stuff that's outside the regular kind of tropes of war film. And so that guy's great. You know, I love his movies.
Yeah.
People get confused when you choose a favorite, and they often attach the person to their work.
Right.
You know, like a famous example, like Picasso. He's made some great paintings at Picasso, but he was not a great guy.
No.
Like, he was a bit of a dick.
This is, by the way, this is a perfect time to not be a good guy. Nothing bad is happening to not good guys these days.
We're having a struggle. Us white guys are not doing well. We are not faring well right now.
I would just say guys. I mean, yeah, there's a ton of white ones. But thankfully, race is not seeing a divide in this world either, or sexual orientation. If you are a bad man, things are happening right now.
Yeah.
And I'm with you. I find it very hard to, like, I wake up every day praying the Coen brothers don't start trending on Twitter or Facebook.
Because it would be bad.
Because it means they're either dead or something awful has happened. Oh, God, please. It's like... And now, like, you know, 2 years ago when I saw like a celebrity trending, I was like, oh my God, they're dead. Now I'm like, oh my God, please be dead, because I don't want anything to taint everything that's happening right now. But I'm with you. I can't separate the art from the artist. Like if I know someone's even just an asshole, like it just doesn't treat people well, I'm like, it taints the way I look at what they're doing, be it musicians, be it directors, actors, anyway. Right? Like, I just want, this is where I sit. In my world, and it's not a pleasant one, but in my world, I want everyone to be nice. I want everyone to be a good person.
Right.
Right?
I don't think that's unreasonable. That's a fantastic place to be.
Apparently, it's impossible.
Yes, it is.
I don't know why.
It absolutely is.
I open up screaming Google every day. It's like, no, okay, not today. Everyone's an asshole.
Yeah. Good guys finish last.
Right. I'm with you on Tarantino.
Yeah.
What brought me, not that I was off him, but like, and this is I hate to admit this in front of a director. I watched this on a plane, was Hateful Eight. Blown away by it. I was not ready for how great that was. So as a result, I have, you know, now watched it on the larger screen. But like, here's a question for you as a director. With technology being what it is, that now I can now pick up this phone and watch whatever piece of work that you've done on it.
Yep.
Which is an immediate way to distribute quickly, but is certainly not the way that it's intended to be viewed. Mm-hmm. I hear, blanking on his name, the creator of Vince Gilligan.
Yeah.
You listen to his podcast when they put out Better Call Saul or whatever, they take meticulous film scale director's approach to every episode. And it bugs him when people are watching it on their phones.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you have that? Does that offend you in any way? Or are you just happy people are watching it? Or like, because obviously you want to put it on the medium that you've put it towards, but like.
100% you do.
Yeah.
But it doesn't bug me.
Okay.
I'm that guy. It does not bug me. But here, I'll qualify that. It doesn't bug me because just simply flat out, like most things I think, it just doesn't. And there's not a whole bunch of special reasons for them. But I can make up some special reasons.
Sure.
Here is the thing, is that I have a background in art. So I started as a photographer first, which is why I graduated into music videos so easily. Because music videos were really applications of fine art photography type techniques, but just made into motion picture.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all intended to be seen.
Yeah.
You know, so a music video is a very difficult thing to watch on a small screen because, in fact, you can't really see what's going on. And there generally isn't much story.
Mm-hmm.
On a smaller screen, when you're delivering a big story, it doesn't really make that much difference.
Right.
Absolutely. Picture and image are extraordinarily important to telling the story behind a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Sound and the actual narrative itself are the two other fence posts that you hang everything upon.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these three elements. You have like narrative and story. You have sound and you have picture. Those things together will make a fantastic movie.
Mm-hmm.
I can truly enjoy watching something on my phone. And I have many nights. We were once down in Barbados and I had no other way to watch anything except for in bed on my phone using Wi-Fi. And I had some Netflix.
Right.
Caribbean Netflix.
Oh, geez.
And it was fantastic. I was watching all kinds of television series and things.
Right.
I loved it. It was really brilliant. So I think it's that you want to wrap your head around the moment that you are in is how I enjoy those things, rather than coming to every particular moment with a predisposition about what I should and shouldn't be feeling.
Right. I 100% agree. There are some movies that like as soon as I see them come out, I go, going to see this in the theater, be it for the action experience, if it's like, you know, like an epic action picture like Guardians of the Galaxy or Star Wars. You want to see that huge screen.
Absolutely.
Whether it's a director I enjoy, like I want to see exactly what they're doing. But there are other times when I look at a movie and go, I can't wait for Netflix.
I'm the same way. That saves me $12.50.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I love going to other different countries and seeing what their Netflix is. My favorite thing is when you're in a country, Netflix goes, whoa, how'd you get there? Like, we'll find something for you. Do you like Norse singing? Here you go. There's that. It's so interesting picking up as well, like, sort of, I think the Netflix for a country gives you a sense of what those norms are as well. So, they're very, very different.
Yeah.
I'm seeing more and more Bollywood movies coming up on regular old Netflix, which is great.
Yes, it is great. Yeah. The cross-cultural pollination of different kinds of films is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. It really helps us all understand each other better.
Right. I have no problems reading a film. I'm fine with that. I'm okay with it. We're going to talk more about your films. We're going to take a quick ad break right now. I remember watching the Tannenbaums.
Okay.
And the Royal Tannenbaums. And I'm 3/4 of the way through it. And I'm literally watching it going, I could randomly say a sentence right now and it would make as much sense as this dialogue.
I love that you thought that. But I kind of loved that. I sort of loved it. Yeah.
I get it.
I'm a weird, yeah.
I completely get it.
Yeah.
And I was off the boil with him for quite a while. And then I saw the one he did about the hotel.
What was that again? Magnolia.
Yeah.
I've forgotten too, yeah.
The Beauty Magnolia Hotel or something like that. Something like that. I love that.
Okay.
Because it was whimsical and foolish. Like, it came in as, like, this is a fairy tale.
Okay, yeah.
And I got that.
Right.
And then The Fantastic Mr. Fox, loved it.
Interesting. See, I didn't...
Adored that movie.
Okay, I got to watch that again.
Yeah. George Clooney is a fox.
Yeah.
How are you not going to like that?
How are you not going to like that?
Meanwhile, P.T. Anderson, you just go, oh, this will be a nice yarn. Oh, dear. Yeah.
There will be blood.
Oh, yeah. One of my favorite movies of all time is Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
Because it's just, it's not about what you think it's going to be about. It's about the 80s just being this derelict wasteland of people creating stuff with cocaine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I love that movie for that reason, but I didn't really truly, like, it didn't make me want to make movies when I saw Magnolia.
Right.
Like, this wants me to make movies.
Right.
You know, as did Pulp Fiction, as did some of those other ones, you know?
Right.
Well, Boogie Nights was great, though. I just loved it. But it was like documentary style.
So I'm with you on Magnolia, because Magnolia, when you leave that theater, you're halfway to your car, and then you stop suddenly, keys in hand, and go, what?
Frogs?
Yeah, right.
What?
Yes. Because when the frogs come, and literally there's a child saying, and then the frogs came. You go... okay. But then there's an of course. You go, okay, of course. And then when you're replaying it in the back, we go, like, I have friends of mine that I'll talk about Magnolia. And they go, I don't remember that one. I go, Tom Cruise, he plays like that guy who's like pitching the game and stuff like that. No, it's not. And then the politician, he's fucking the secretary. He's like, no, it's not that. That's his dad. The frogs, they fall. Oh, the frogs, right? And it's just so... only he could put something like that into a film and make it work. There Will Be Blood, same story. Like, it's just staggeringly thick with everything going on. Like, it's shot perfectly. As a photographer, originally, that I'm guessing is where you get your eye for that sort of thing.
You bet.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was all about the frame.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned to balance a frame. So I went to the Ontario College of Art and Design, and, you know, it was about framing. It was about photography and what's inside every frame. And it's really easy to waste your time as a filmmaker because motion pictures got thousands of frames all the time. But once you've got the discipline, you don't have to, it's not overwhelming to be able to say, I need to be conscious of frame all day long, every day, you know?
I didn't realize, like, until I was talking with directors about, like, what the actual lessons that you learn in film school, like a want to make something sinister, drop the angle down about 5, you know, 5 to 10, or like, because I was wondering, like, I know these choices are being made, but I didn't realize why.
Interesting.
And like the reverse pan instead of going left to right, go right to left, because people aren't used to reading it, and then that's where, oh, that's where the monster is. And, you know, it's like, it's that sort of thing.
Yes.
I just as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh, thank you for ruining movies for me from now on.
Yeah, you know, I mean, honestly, I didn't go to film school. I went to art school. Mm-hmm. And there are guys who could cite you those rules. But mm-hmm. I don't know many of them.
Right.
And as a director who – and I've directed lots of stuff. And, you know, all of it hasn't sucked. Some of it has. But all of it's been pretty good. But all I'm going to say is I don't know those rules generally, because in the end, when you learn the visual language, having the rules at your fingertip is less relevant than on the moment, just mm-hmm. understanding instinctually what's going to work for this particular right. shot. So there are many, many people who work intellectually, like you've just described, mm. but most of them are critics.
Sure.
I think you'll discover that most directors, and Scorsese and Spielberg and all those guys who are the top ones, are on the same list. They don't spend a lot of time, you know, intellectually trying to figure things out. They understand instinctively how mm-hmm. it should work. Right. And what I've read about them tells me that they go and they make their movies just mm-hmm. from their heart.
Right.
You know who is really good at sort of intellectually deciding when and when not to use certain camera techniques or horror film directors? Guys like John Carpenter.
Right.
And that's because, right, they are looking to directly build up to a response. And that mm-hmm. response needs to be elicited, like, precisely. You got to be scared as shit
right.
at this particular moment. So they're contriving those moments in ways that are very disciplined.
Mm-hmm. And then, like, when you watch those, like, that branch of horror movies, I'm gonna kind of throw that in, like the John Carpenter, there's I remember being frightened by a Soderbergh movie, Contagion, right?
Yes.
Because it was a virus movie, but it wasn't a run away from the monkey virus movie. It was a, we have this virus, it's a pandemic, and it is decimating the world economically. There's wars going on. People get, like, it's really taking the toll of everything that was going on. I found that movie horrific, but it wasn't really a horror movie. It's like, kind of like, you know, when Walking Dead gets into the 7th season, it's like, it's not about zombies anymore. It's yeah. about wanting to kill the person beside you, because that's where all the food is going to go. So it's that kind of breakdown of it. So, like, it's that divorcing of story, but still is horrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And that's a much more layered and complicated versioning of horror mm-hmm. than, for instance, the big scary horror
films. Right.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw Get Out.
I loved Get Out.
Yeah.
Get Out changed my life. It's the way we're going to go.
Yeah.
It's the way that I want to be traveling, and Stegman is following in its footsteps because,
yeah.
you know, comedy and horror are a new genre that's coming forward.
Yeah. But so here again, I've been listening a lot to Corina Longworth and her podcast called You Must Remember This. And it covers, like, the first 100 years of Hollywood. And so, you know, from that to about, I guess, the 1950s, 60s, whatever. And even back then, in like the 50s and 60s, they were doing all kinds of comedy horrors, because there was a distribution channel. I know I'm going to butcher this, Corina Longworth. I apologize in advance. It used to be that movie theaters would be owned by studios. And by all means, yes, write that down. Write that down there. The notepad that I just referred to, ladies and gentlemen, it's the Wong Sisters, the inadvertent sponsor of this podcast. When for all your real estate needs, you call the Wong Sisters. You know what happens, David, when you call the Wong Sisters?
You buy real estate.
Wong number. Now listen, I make that joke every week. The studios used to own the movie theaters, so they would put in B movies and C movies within the studio system. So that's why you had like the serials come out, and, like, you know, kind of schlocky movies, and then, like, it was like a big 4 or 5 hour event that you go through. When the I guess the government said, no, studios can't own movie theaters anymore. The independent theaters went, okay, we're just going to grab the hits. And they're like, whoa, now we have no room for B movies or C movies. So it became, there was a tier below the independent cinemas that was like the ultra independent. They would go, we'll take those. And so that's where you're seeing, like, a lot of, like, Bela Lugosi meets a Brooklyn Gorilla or whatever it was, right? And it was like all these stupid kind of scary, but like humorous, scary movies, right? And I'm glad I'm giving a history of film to David Hyde, the director. But I love, I'm with you. I loved what Get Out did, which was still made scary but entertaining, funny. You know?
Agreed.
It was it was a perfect line to walk.
And it was brand new. You could feel it was fresh. And you can tell the market responded properly. Mm-hmm. That's fancy words for saying people liked it.
Yes. Is that the buzzword they're using now?
Market responding properly.
The market is responding properly to this. That's right. I just... So let's take a look at your resume. We are going to talk about Stegman in a moment.
Sure. No.
But I want to go through this because like it just shows sort of like the rich kind of like how you got to here. Music videos for sure.
Oh yeah.
You know, bread and butter, kept a roof over your head the whole bit. You did two shows in particular that one my wife loves and one that I love. Property Brothers and Come Dine with Me Canada.
You betcha.
Yeah. Guess who liked which one?
Oh, I'm thinking that you're the cook.
She's the cook. I adore Come Dine With
Me. I picked it. Oh, right. Is that right?
I adore Come Dine. She's the cook.
I would have picked
her.
But that's
her. She, as soon as Property Brothers is on, I have lost her. Anything with that or a House Hunters International?
Heard of it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Where it's just like, this couple wants to move to this neighborhood. They have no hope of ever affording, right? Yeah. And they come up with a laundry list of like, we want a pool and four bedrooms, but we don't want to spend more than $80,000. Okay. That's a bit hand-tying. And all these shows just, like of that ilk just distill down to the title, he's an idiot, she's a bitch. Like, that's what happens by the end of the episode. They should just roll it right into a divorce court. Afterwards, because you look at this relationship, and go, they're not going to survive this.
Funny,
it's not going to be it. But I love like the Property Brothers for sure. Like they help anchor kind of the storyline. Like they sort of take over, and they've got what is working on those reality shows like for you as a director?
Well, listen, you know, it was surprise. I'm going to say I'll take it. I'm going to spread it out a little bit because I have done a couple of those reality shows.
Right,
I started. Mm-hmm. Directing reality television because there was a business there. And actually there were jobs. Mm-hmm. And jobs that I could get.
Right.
As
a voice actor myself, you're talking about taking work, right?
Yeah. I'm talking about the kind of thing that sort of adds up to, you know, I would like to eat.
Yeah.
And I also would like to sleep. Mm-hmm. Out of the rain.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of those jobs came to me because I needed to sort of make a living, of course. But mm-hmm. it was shocking and surprising how much satisfaction I got from working on the shows. And the best example of that was when I got on the series Four Weddings Canada.
Okay.
Four Weddings is a television series about brides competing with each other for a wedding. I haven't been married.
Okay.
I didn't know anything about weddings. And I didn't care. But I got on this show.
Okay.
And I actually truly enjoyed making it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't enjoy watching it. But I did deeply enjoy the process of making it because the crew was great. The people were great who were on the show were fantastic. And the actual process itself of creating things and making something that was well-loved and well-embraced is always a satisfying experience.
Okay.
So I'll say the same thing about Property Brothers and Come Dine With Me. Mm-hmm. Like, they're very, very popular shows, as was Four Weddings Canada. And that always helps because, you know, you're making something that's got a lot of gravity behind it. But essentially, I took those jobs just because, of course, I was taking work and I had to make a living while I was writing things like Stegman and writing – I mean, I've done other independent films. And so
– The thing I love about Come Dine With Me and the Four Weddings, I love the competition aspect of it because nothing, no matter how contrived, drives viewers to something than, oh, someone's going to lose, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you ever remember who the winners are? No. It's always like the list of losers.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't know how hers turned out, but I believe a comedian friend of mine was on Come Dine With Me Canada. Does the name Martha O'Neill ring a bell to you?
No.
Okay.
So but there were many, many. And there was at least four directors on that show,
okay,
and it went many seasons. I only did one of the seasons. Mm-hmm. I did a meager 50 episodes.
Jesus.
I mean, there were probably a
50
couple.
Episodes.
There's 50 episodes. But the thing about Come Dine With Me was...
Oh, because, yeah, they were...
You'd shoot 5 episodes in a week.
Right. So when you're doing these, are you actually, like, on set with them? Or are you just, like... Are you, like... Are you in the room, or like you are you in like a production studio elsewhere, and you're just getting the feeds going, move that camera over there, move that, like, how does that work? Like, what's the mechanics around it?
No, Come Dine With Me was a show that was made on location.
Okay.
So as the director, you're there in somebody's house.
Okay.
You throw up a couple of lights, you have a camera crew, and you fit, you know, 10 other people in that room, and then you end up with your subjects in their house, and every day is a different location.
Right. So that's a challenge.
That's a challenge.
Because you have no idea what the architecture of that place is going to be.
You have none whatsoever. I mean, you can scout it ahead of time. And that's not really the trick, because people are sitting at a table.
Mm-hmm.
The struggle is just to continue to drive forward any sort of story. So as a director, really, right. you're not directing cameras. You're not trying to pick shots. Although you do contribute, of course, because you need to get certain story points covered.
Right.
But really what you do is prompt the people in that room to stay on track.
Right.
And continue to reveal... their end of the story.
Right.
Because those shows are all made in the casting room.
Right.
So you end up and you say, I'm going to pick a bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be 5 of them. And right. we'll look at these 50 people. And out of those 50, these 5 in particular, the alchemy of their combination will make a great, fantastic show.
Right.
So as a director, you step into that knowing, okay, I've got these kind of iconic roles for each one of these people. They're all going to play a particular kind of thing against each other. And then you keep that on track. Using interviews
right.
and live in situation techniques, and that way you end up with some fun stuff.
Right. And that is the thing, having, again, not an in-depth knowledge of the industry. Like, I have done some screen acting, but certainly not in the reality side, but, like, I have friends in the industry that have dropped that hat to me. Like, way early on, it's like, reality TV is not a reality.
No.
It is, you know, it is equally as scripted. Like, there will be points when... we're watching Chopped or something.
Oh, yeah.
And someone will be like, oh, my God, I put skim milk in instead of whole milk in this. That's a producer plot point. Like, probably someone came over and got swapper milk out, you know, like, whatever.
Hilarious. And by the way, I don't know if that's true or not, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Right. The moment that I adore is whenever they do the backstory, like you're saying. It's like, so what brings you here? And it's just some very earnest chef going, well, you know, we had a rough go. My dad died of cancer just recently, and we were, you know, it's really been rough. And so I know he's up there looking at me, and I know he's going to be proud. And they just cut to him being chopped, like the next one guy. Sorry, your souffle fell. Yeah. Pardon me. I am.
Yeah.
This is the season for just getting over colds, apparently.
Okay, yeah.
This one has been lingering. I don't know why. And it only comes when I need to talk to people.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that's about right. Yeah.
What do you do for sick days when you're on location? Like, what's, have you had the, like, because I'm also looking at the, what was the show you did? Ice Road, the Trucks on the Road. What was it? Why am I blanking on the name?
No, I graduated from making those kinds of lifestyle reality right. shows to Man TV.
Yes.
So I went on the road, I went on and did Ice Road Truckers.
That's the one.
And Yukon Gold.
Mm-hmm.
And several others. And those were amazing shows. Those were life experiences.
Right.
Making those programs.
So when you're doing those, again, are you on location?
Oh, yeah. No, I was, so on Ice Road Truckers, I was the guy in the cab of the truck.
Oh.
So as that truck crashes, there's a camera in there. That's me. I was in the passenger side seat.
Jesus.
So when the driver talks, you're, as the director, you're there shooting your own camera. And asking the questions and building the show that way. So that's how you are a director, because you editorialize the story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, what's happening? Is a wheel blowing up? And you get the guy to comment on whether or not.
Jeepers. Yeah. That's harrowing.
No, it was. It was definitely harrowing. And it was honestly, it was an amazing show to work on. I mean, my favorite show of all was Yukon Gold.
Okay.
Where I went and embedded a couple of 100 kilometers north of Dawson City.
Right.
With some gold miners. 11 rapist redneck gold miners.
Uh-huh.
And for 3.5 months, we lived in the bush to make that show. And we made, 8 1-hour episodes or something. And that was truly, I mean, you know, I'm a big outdoorsman. I love camping. I've done a lot of canoeing. And I grew up with that background. And luckily, I had those skills because they all, you know, when you walk out of your construction trailer, which is what they drop down for you to sleep in every night, me and my crew, four other guys all slept in the same room for 3.5 months in the middle of the woods.
Right.
Through August, September, October in the Yukon.
Jeepers.
And you really, you know, need to have some backwoods skills on your side. Because when you're not shooting and when the regular kind of infrastructure of work isn't there, you're still living there every day, all day long. So I walked out of the trailer at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to the bathroom. You got to be conscious of whether or not there's a bear or somebody outside. Yeah.
Where did you grow up that you had had camping skills?
No, we're a cottage family.
Oh, okay.
So it's just northern Ontario.
Okay.
The Canadian Shield, there's some good territory up there.
Oh, yeah. I'm from small town Ontario myself, so like you know, I've got friends of mine. Certainly, I am not in this camp, but like friends of mine who would shoot and eat everything that they ate. So like every part of the deer is like in their freezer at some point. But I'm staggered by the peril that you must have seen over the course of those projects. It must be nice to have something calming and steady, like a murder comedy.
Oh yes. Yeah.
Before we get to the segment.
Oh, yeah.
Elvis Costello.
Yes. Amazing.
Talk to me about this.
Oh, brilliant.
This is astounding.
Yeah. No, there is an excellent producer in Canada named Marty Cates.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a friend of mine just through the community. And he called me one day and said, David, I've got no money. But I want to make – I've been making this TV series for the Sundance Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And Elvis Costello is the host of it. And I'm backstage during – the filming of this show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extraordinary what goes on. And I'm like, and I hadn't heard of it. And I was like, okay, well, what goes on? And he's like, well, we're inviting people like Sting and Bono from U2 and the world's most famous and extraordinarily talented musicians to come and jam it with Elvis Costello.
Right.
So what they do backstage before they go on stage and display what they have come up with is they come up with it. So they sit in a dressing room together and they come up with a medley of Elvis Costello songs and U2 songs. David, I want you to write and direct a one-hour show about the making of this show because really that's the best part of the show.
Right.
And so we took that challenge on. I had a business partner named Robin Begay, and she and I together went out and we shot for 4 or 5 months. We went to Harlem, and we shot the Elvis Costello show when it played in the Apollo Theater there.
Beauty.
You know, I think Sheryl Crow and Nico Case and a bunch of others were there at that time. We did, you know, like the Bruce Springsteen show and the Sting show and a whole bunch of others. And we were able to come up with this beautiful sort of tapestry of creative collaborations between some of the world's most extraordinary musical minds.
Right.
You know, at the risk of sounding pretentious about it, like that's literally what it was and why it was so amazing.
Right.
And then Robin and I went out and we found people to comment on that. So, you know, it's not hard to call Rolling Stone and say, hey, who's your top music journalist?
Right.
Get them to tell us.
Uh-huh.
And we are nobodies, by the way.
Yeah.
Get them to be on camera. We'll come to your office and talk about this show with Elvis Costello. And they would. So we ended up with like a bunch of great folks to interview and a bunch of great folks to photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And I really deeply, you know, enjoyed making that program. We were tasked with having it be hosted by a first-time host.
Right.
And he had never been on camera before. So my job was to help train him to be able to, like, take us through. It was like a narrator.
Yeah.
He's the guy who was, like, going to take us through this journey. And that was Elton John's husband.
Right.
David Furnish.
Yeah.
So Furnish and I
became, had never done this before.
And he had never done it before. And he was great, and it wasn't that difficult. And he turned out to be very, very good, you know. But that also led, like, a sort of third dimension of insight. Because he was able to give personal anecdotes.
That's awesome.
It was amazing experience. It really was.
Right.
We interviewed Elton John. We interviewed them all. You know, it was really an amazing experience to talk to those people and to feel the energy they have because it is something that's quite extraordinary.
What was the most surprising interview to you out of all of them? Like where you just go, I was not expecting that from this person.
Mary Louise Parker.
Okay.
Showed up and she loved, had no idea that she was such a music aficionado.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a lot to say, and she was extraordinarily articulate about her thoughts, and she loved Elvis Costello. I was almost as surprised by her as I was when they had Bill Clinton on the show, and it turns out Bill Clinton is like an unbelievable saxophone player.
Of course, right, yeah.
And so it was one of those. It just like really lambasts you. It's like, what is going on here? These people, who are they and where do they come from, for God's sakes? I feel like it's Men in Black where they're going to unzip a skin underneath there's an alien, you know?
Yeah. I get the feeling you can't keep Bill Clinton from playing a saxophone whenever you have him over. It's just like as soon as like anything, like is like, you know, anything that sounds like saxophone. right? I caught my son having phone sex, saxophone. Let me go get that. I got it over here.
That's hilarious. I think you're right.
I can't imagine as soon as I saw like that Costello project, I was like, oh my God. I mean, because I remember that show being on.
Yes.
And it had high points and low points about it. But like to go behind the scenes and describe what you're doing, I think, make that the show.
Yes.
And just give a taste of like what that thing is at the end, because that would be a live thing that you could enjoy there. But like, I think that story is exactly what you described, which is you should have done it. That's all I'm saying. You should have gotten more work. That's all I wanted.
Yeah.
David needed more work. Stegman is dead.
Yes.
Take me through this. You're in post now?
No, we are done.
It's done? Okay.
We are done, yes.
All right. Take me through this. It sounds astounding because, first of all, I love a byline that is the title, which is, Stegman is dead. Let's start there. So?
Where do you go from?
Right,
exactly. Listen, there's a couple of extraordinary things about Stegman is dead. One of them is the story of finance.
Okay.
You know, raising the money for an independent film mm-hmm. is an infamously difficult thing to do.
Right.
We got insanely lucky because I had a fantastic business partner named Juliet Hagopian who took the script
mm-hmm.
after I had co-written it with a guy named Stephen Kuntz.
Okay.
She got on an airplane because she believed in this script so much and went to Hong Kong.
As you do. Right.
When you're looking to make some money, you go to Hong Kong. Where else are you going to go?
That is the first place I go.
China now is known to have some money.
Right.
And in Hong Kong, she was able to sell the script for $500,000 Canadian.
Right.
So we literally sat down to a dinner, Juliet Hagopian and I, and mm-hmm. we opened up an envelope that was mailed to us, and there was a check in our name
right.
for $500,000. Not a word of a lie. And that was an exciting moment.
I guess the question I have right there is, how much did you poo yourself?
Yeah, exactly.
With just a little bit, or was it a torrent?
Yeah. It was pretty darn good.
Yeah.
I felt very light afterwards.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What do you do when you're holding that? Just... I can't picture it.
No, that's how it feels.
I'm that way when I get a scratch and win with a free ticket. I'm like, the next one's going to be the good one.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was extraordinary that you were able to take a bunch of black type on a white page and mm-hmm. turn it into money like that. It's an amazing thing.
Right.
So that was the beginning. We were able to take that nest egg of money and then pile the rest on top because we needed about $1.5 million to make the independent film.
Sure.
And then once you've got something like a foundation of $500,000, mm-hmm. you can easily build the rest on top.
Okay.
Not easily. I mean, you know, it's still a lot of work, but there is a path that is then you're able to follow. Mm-hmm. And Juliet did a very, very, very good job of doing that, you know? So that's the one. I think that the one thing about Stegman that sets it aside from the other 80 independent films that were made in Canada in the year 2017
uh-huh.
is that we financed it using an international co-production model.
Okay.
Normally, international co-productions kind of happened at a price point that was $5 million and above.
Right.
Stegman's obviously far, far below that.
Sure.
So there is a paradigm shift in what's happening now with international markets and independent films. And people are finding ways to make their money back when you're only spending something like $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
A low budget film has not bankable actors. It will have riskier choices for directors mm-hmm. and for crew and for directors of photography and all people who are more building toward the end of their career.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, it's much more of a crapshoot as to whether or not you end up with something that's saleable and able to recoup its investment.
Right.
Stegman was very lucky in that we persevered through all those challenges and we were able to finance. And that's something that didn't happen 2 or 3 years ago.
Right. Because it's funny you mentioned Video Fact. Like, I remember seeing every single video that was being made in Canada just had, you know, the production company Video Fact at the bottom. It was listed in like the credits that we had.
Yeah, I think I got 12 of them. I built my career on those mm-hmm. things. And I'm so sad for filmmakers in the year 2017 because they don't have that resource any longer as an aside. So anyway, sorry to interrupt.
Well, no, but you like you watch all of your, like any reality show made in Canada always has like, you know, at the end, like the, you know, the logo for Canada and like the Maple Keys. for the
there's Canada tax rebate, all the tax rebates, and
right?
Tax
all
funds
like
and,
all of those things are coming up in the crisis, stuff like that. So it's nice to see that there is movement going towards like people willing to take a risk, because what you're offering and what movies of this ilk are offering is a substantially smaller risk for a larger percentage of a probability of making that money back.
Yeah.
Because it's so little ventured on their part. Anything like, I remember this tweet from like about a year ago, and it's just the guy went, oh, this is why M. Night Shyamalan keeps making movies, because his production costs are so low, like $600,000. And then the movie in an opening weekend will make $6 million. So like he's making 10 times, 20 times in some cases, you know, the money back. He's like, oh, that's why.
That's why.
Uh-huh.
That works. As a business model, that works.
And he started as an independent film in himself.
Of
right?
course so, he did, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So take us through Stegman is Dead. What's I don't want to spoil the story. You hear me. No. You do it. Yes.
So Stegman is Dead is the story of a father and daughter.
Yes.
And they get bound up in a series of hijinks that leads them to the home of a porn director, while some of the world's best hitmen are trying to break in.
Right. I didn't want to give that away. I'm like... I can't say that. I don't want, let him say that, because that you have that in just like a review. I'm there. I don't even care. This is what I love about like situational things like this, because film and creation of media has become so immediate. What is happening now is a shift to situational comedies that are able to go really far. Ted, for example, a guy that talks to his teddy bear. What was the movie where the guy plays his dog, or the TV show guy? It was originally in Australia.
I don't think I've seen it.
There's an actor that plays the guy's dog, and the it's just like, you know, a guy in a dog suit.
Right. Yeah.
And he's just talking to him like that, like Trailer Park Boys.
Yeah.
You would never have had that show 20 years ago. But you can now, because anyone can make anything very cheaply. And what I love about that is, sure, there's going to be hit and miss, but the attempt to make something that is so out far the regular mainstream in terms of plot turns and storyline is wonderful. And as soon as I read this summary, I'm like, oh, yeah, we got to talk to this guy. So did the script come to you, or did you create this, or like this is all you?
No, not at all.
No,
the script came to me. The original idea was written by a guy named Stephen Kuntz.
Okay, right.
And Stephen and I were friends. We shared the same agent.
Okay.
And nobody would touch the script.
Why is that?
I don't know. Yeah. Who knows? It's ridiculous. I saw a market value in that.
Right.
Script. Yeah. I don't know. It was a script that wasn't well embraced by a lot of people. And I said, listen, Stephen, I want to option this from you. Let's work on it together.
Right.
And we did. And in the end, we got to make that film.
Yeah.
So it was a fantastic journey. You know, it's brilliant.
I love the, I'm sure you've seen the movie Living in Oblivion.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So where they're doing room tone and they cut to everyone who's doing like their thoughts inside, and Steve Buscemi as the director is accepting the fake Oscar, but it's obviously an Oscar, and telling everyone in his life that said no to him to go fuck themselves. And it's like, it's wonderful. It's like, I can only imagine, you know, I love picturing every single director going into a room with whatever project they have that makes billions. And it's like, yeah, Steven, it's a big shark. I'm sure it'll be great. Not for us. Right? Like, it's just that. It's like, oh, you want to do something about Schindler? Who's that? I don't know. Oh, it's in Hitler's Germany? Bye-bye. Don't need it. Like all of that. Like, I'm just like, every time I hear someone making a pass on that, I just picture like how the pitch meeting went in my head for the people who didn't take it. You know?
Yeah.
Because 90% of what we do is just rejection.
Oh, yeah. Easily. You know? 90, maybe 95.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
I know as a comic, 90% of everything I write is crap. And so you're always looking for that 10% that's always good. But that 90 you have to swim through is horrible. And I can only imagine, like, every time you get, like, so many doors slam in your face. And then suddenly the one that opens, you just go, oh, thank you.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, and what I've discovered through the arc of my career is that less and less doors slam because I'm throwing less spaghetti, less proverbial spaghetti at the wall.
Right.
So it's like I'm picking things that I believe that will work better now and testing less because I know, you know what, if I was to do this, then it probably won't work. But if I did that, then it probably will. And making those probably choices leads to a higher ratio of success than I used to have.
Right. So when you look at a script like Stegman is Dead.
Yeah. No, that was a probably I have no idea script.
Okay. When you look at it, as you're reading it, are you already starting to construct shots in your head and you're already storyboarding as you're like...
Oh, 100%. That's how I read. I read very, very visually. I never just read through editorially. I'm really like a visual person first and a literate person second.
Okay.
So that's how, I see it and then decide whether or not I am part of that world.
Okay.
And so Stegman I got because it's much like Get Out. In that, like, it's funny, but it's dark at the same time. Mm-hmm.
I can't wait to see this thing. It's going to be so fun. Where can people go see it?
Stegman is Dead was in theaters in Toronto last week.
Okay.
We did very well.
Yes.
It will air in Winnipeg.
Okay.
This weekend.
All right.
And then the Canadian distributors got it in theaters coming up. And I don't know what the dates are. Super Channel. No, here's what I do know. Okay. iTunes and Super Channel iTunes and Super Channel are dropping it on December 12th.
Okay. Perfect. Okay. So keep an eye out for it in regular theaters, which will be happening soon. Sometime. You know what? Christmas Day.
Maybe Christmas Day.
When you're sick of the parents. Blammo. I was shocked. Of course it makes sense because not everyone has Christmas, but I love seeing more and more movies opening on Christmas. It's just like, oh, when you're sick of the, we're just going to go out for some air 3 hours later, come back reeking of popcorn and Diet Coke. Yeah, it's perfect. David, thank you so much for coming by.
Honestly, thank you for having me.
This was, I cannot wait to see this. I'm going to go back and rewatch a whole bunch of videos right now. Where do people find you online? What's your internet presence?
You can just find me at David Hyde, DavidHydeFilms.com.
Okay.
But you know, if you weed through David Hyde Pierce and David Hyde the security guy, you'll find me on Google.
Once you get through, you got to go through 90% of shit and then you find the golden nugget.
It's like the independence, it's a metaphor for independence.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. David, thank you so much for coming down. Let me boilerplate us out of here. Speaking of Twitter and the internet and the like, you can follow this very podcast at CATP Podcast. That's right, folks. Cat P. You can follow me personally at HayesTBA. Go onto iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. You know the drill. 5-star rating, talk shit about us in the commentary. 5-star rating, talk shit about us in the commentary. Point it towards me. Things like, Todd wouldn't know a good Coen Brothers movie if it bit him in the Hudsucker proxy. Something like that. Also make sure you check out all the other podcasts that are part of the Entertainment One podcast channel. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of David the Erstwhile Darcy and myself, when you listen to Cat P, you're in for a good time. Jimmy, you are always the podcat.
Lately, I find I rush.